This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Josh and I are here with Dr. Jacinda Delhaize from the University of Zagreb. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, you're here for a meeting, a star formation rating, is that right?
Yes, I'm here in Manchester for the measuring star formation rates in the millimetre, submillimetre and radio.
That is a title and a half.
It is a long title.
So could you start off by telling us a little bit about your research?
Yes, well, first of all, hello. My name is Jacinta Delhaize and I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Zagreb, which is in Croatia. But actually, I'm from Australia. I grew up in Perth in Western Australia. I did my Bachelor of Science degree there and then my PhD in Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Western Australia and also partly at University of Oxford here in the UK. So I've spent a bit of time in the UK and I really, really enjoy my time here. Mm-hmm. Although strangely, I got almost culture shocked when I arrived here yesterday. It feels weird that I'm supposed to speak English.
I suppose unlike in Zagreb.
Yeah, and also it was 40 degrees in Zagreb and I got here and it was raining. Oh, I didn't pack appropriately.
That's quite the welcome.
Yeah. Yes, but my research is, well, I'm a radio astronomer and my field of research is galaxy evolution, sort of in general. And I've sort of jumped around a bit in my research within that field for my PhD, for honours, which is sort of like master's, and for my postdoc. What I currently work on with my research team at the University of Zagreb, there's about seven of us, and we work on a large radio survey with the Carl G. Jansky Very Large Array Telescope, which is in New Mexico in the USA. Our team leader, Vanessa Smolcich, won about 400 hours to conduct a large survey using this telescope. And we pointed the telescope at a patch of sky called Cosmos, the Cosmos field. And this is 2 square degrees. So if you extend your thumb out at night and you look pointed at the full moon, the full moon is about 0.5 of a square degree. And Cosmos, about 9 or 10 full moons would fit inside the Cosmos field. So it's actually quite a big patch of sky.
It's huge, yeah.
It's quite big, yeah. And so this particular patch of sky is quite special because about 10 years ago it was observed with Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope. And since then it's been observed with almost all of the major ground and space-based telescopes. So, of course, we have telescopes that are sensitive to all of the different wavelengths of light, from the X-rays through the ultraviolet, optical, infrared, and into the radio. And what our team did was to contribute a new radio survey. So we basically made a map of the sky at radio wavelengths. Ours was at 3 gigahertz, which is a wavelength of 10 centimeters. So you can actually measure that with a ruler, the wavelength of that light. And in this, we found 11,000 galaxies. Not all, most of them had already been discovered before, but we found 11,000 of them you could detect in the radio light. And what you see in the radio are two general populations of galaxies, star-forming galaxies, so galaxies that are forming a lot of stars, and also AGN, active galactic nuclei. So these are, of course, galaxies that have supermassive black holes in the center, gas and dust falling into these black holes and releasing huge amounts of energy, some of which is in the radio. So we can see these two different populations in radio waves at 3 gigahertz. Our science is about studying how galaxies have changed over time. So we know that as you look deeper and deeper into space, you're looking back in time, and that galaxies that you see further away look very different to galaxies that are nearby us in the local universe. And this means that over time, galaxies have changed since they formed after the Big Bang till now. And we call this galaxy evolution. So with this survey, it's very, very sensitive, which means that we can see very, very faint and very small details. And this helps us to push studies of galaxy evolution to sort of the cutting edge beyond what was possible before. My particular paper that we've recently published is about something called the infrared radio correlation. So you have massive stars forming within galaxies, and the biggest of these stars, they can heat up the dust clouds that surround them, and the dust then glows at infrared wavelengths. So you can see them in, you can see the galaxies glowing at infrared wavelengths because of these massive stars. After a few million years, the biggest of these stars die in dramatic supernova explosions, and these accelerate electrons nearly to the speed of light. And as the electrons interact with the magnetic field of the galaxy, they release radio light. So we think it's because of these massive stars that you can see both infrared and radio light from a given galaxy. And in fact, the amount of infrared and radio light coming from a galaxy are very, very closely related, and this is called the infrared radio correlation. So what I did with this new radio data, and also with very good quality far infrared data from the Herschel Space Telescope, was to have a close look at this infrared radio correlation and how it's changed over the history of the universe. So far, we've been able to study it a lot in the nearby universe, in galaxies that are around us, but we've lacked the good quality data to be able to study this out to further and further distances. And what I found was that it changes very slightly. So galaxies that existed earlier on in the universe released more radio light compared to the amount of infrared light.
Was that something you expected?
We weren't really sure what to expect, because we have to make a lot of assumptions when we study this. We have to assume that the same types of stars form, that the number of stars form, how much dust is in these galaxies. We have to assume that many things stay the same. And, of course, that's not the actual reality, but without the ability to measure these things, the best we can do is say, if we make this set of assumptions, what does the data tell us?
So what does it possibly tell you that this difference you're seeing changes over time? Mm-hmm.
So we're not entirely sure why we see this change, but we have a few ideas, and we're working on some more studies to try and understand it. One possibility is that we don't actually understand properly how much radio light we should see from a galaxy at each wavelength of radio. And so we might be making some assumptions there that are meaning that we are overestimating how much radio light we're receiving. Another issue is that we think that what I was looking at was the infrared radio correlation of the star-forming galaxies. But we may accidentally have AGN in our sample, so these active galactic nuclei with the supermassive black holes in the centre. And if that's the case, then the radio light coming from the AGN is probably contaminating what we're assuming is coming from the star formation. And this may also be why we're measuring too much radio light.
So how do you go about attempting to filter out an AGN galaxy from a star-forming galaxy?
Okay, so there are a few different ways we can spot AGN. We have to use lots of different wavelengths. So we can spot them in the X-rays. They have certain characteristics in their X-ray light. We can spot them in the mid-infrared. And if we look at their general light pattern with over a vast range of wavelengths, so we call the spectral energy distribution, they also have some particular characteristics there. So there are these different ways that we can pick them out of the general sample in a statistical way. But also, these objects usually have strong radio excess, so a lot more radio light compared to the other wavelengths. And in particular, when you have a radio survey, you can identify different AGN to what you can at other wavelengths, because usually you have AGN that can emit at all of these different types of light, are very energetic in the X-rays, in the mid-infrared, in the optical, and may or may not have a lot of radio light. But there are also some other peculiar types of AGN which you can only identify in the radio.
Why is there that difference between the peculiar type that only emit in the radio and the other type that emit in across the spectrum?
That's actually a really good question, and we don't really understand why yet. So that's a new field of research that is progressing at the moment. One scenario is due to the way that they are accreting or having gas fall onto the black hole. There, we think there might be different modes of what we call accretion, and this could be causing a different different output of light at the other end. And there are other theories around that try and explain this, but so far this is another field that we're trying to work on, and the next generation of radio telescopes of the future will hopefully help us to pin these questions down.
And when you say different modes, is that when people talk about like radio mode and I can't remember the other one?
Quasar mode, yeah. Radio mode. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is actually old sort of nomenclature, which a lot of people do still use. But as we're getting more and more data and more information, a lot of the nomenclature very quickly becomes redundant because we're realizing that the physical processes involved are very different to what we thought they were in the first place. So whatever words we were using, need to kind of be discarded. But there's a lot of controversy about this because certain people have a very strong view about what they think is going on, and other people have a very different view, and also different astronomers tend to work at particular wavelengths, and there is it's not easy to bring everybody together and have a general consensus of what's going on in these really strange and really interesting objects. So more and more there are more conferences around the world to really try and bring astronomers from different wavelengths together to try and discuss this problem, because we're all talking about the same thing but we're using different words, so it's really hard to try and figure out what's going on.
So have you got a theory that you favour currently?
I don't think I have a particular theory. It's not really my field. I work more on star-forming galaxies. But in our recent series of papers that we've published from my team at the University of Zagreb, we sort of introduced a new nomenclature, which is HERGs and LERGs, which are moderate to high excitation radio galaxies and low to moderate excitation radio galaxies. And this is to do with their radiative luminosity. So all we're saying is that we don't really know what's going on inside them, but we're going to name these things based on their emission signatures. So not what we're assuming is the physics of what's going on, but based on how bright they are at the wavelengths that we can see them. And in this way, we can then later on say, okay, these HERGs are probably these objects, say, radio mode objects that somebody else is describing, which is actually more describing their physical properties their underlying physics rather than their observational properties.
And how would that particular naming system work across different wavelengths? Because I imagine if you're naming them based on their emission in the radio and then an X-ray astronomer comes along, I guess then it's difficult for them to characterize the objects they're seeing.
It's a gigantic headache. Yeah, it's really difficult to try and get this consensus about all of these naming systems, because of course everybody is working on their own research and everybody is using nomenclature that really works for them. So nomenclature, naming system, that really works for them. And we try and bring it all together, but it's a gigantic international slow moving beast that we're trying to all agree on. But of course, another problem is that we don't yet understand the physics that is underneath. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know what to call these things yet. But I think we've generally agreed that there is a supermassive black hole, that there's stuff falling inside it, that it's releasing a lot of energy, and that's an achievement in itself.
So you've spoken about star-forming galaxies and AGN. What are the main differences then in terms of age or like how they exist within the universe? What are the things that you see that differentiate the two?
That's a really great question, because both of these processes are essential in galaxy evolution. So we can see that towards higher redshift, which means further distances in the universe, so back in time, towards earlier in the history of the universe, galaxies formed a lot more stars than they are forming today. And we don't really understand why. We think these two, star formation and AGN processes, are probably tied together somehow. So one scenario is that you have galaxy mergers. So you have two galaxies that are colliding together. And when this collision happens, you have the the individual stars themselves probably don't collide, but the huge clouds of gas and dust between them probably do collide, compress together, and then you get a sudden burst of star formation triggered by this collision. So you have these baby stars forming all over the place. Then possibly what happens is that some of this gas goes spiraling in towards the centers of these colliding galaxies, where we suspect resides a supermassive black hole. And then we call this triggering the black hole, so that it switches on. It starts to release huge, huge amounts of light, of energy, actually, some of which could blow out some of the gas from the galaxy. And we call this feedback. So you can have positive feedback or negative feedback. Maybe some of these processes actually promote further star formation, and some of them maybe quench it, so suppress it, stop further star formation. And it's the balance of these two processes that probably contribute to the galaxies that we see around us. Now, we don't really understand exactly how they're tied together. We don't understand yet the relative contribution of these two processes, and we don't really know when or how much of this is going on. So these are still the questions that remain open for us to try and figure out in the future, and especially with telescopes of the future like the Square Kilometre Array, with the amazing sensitivity and angular resolution of it, this telescope will see very small details, very faint details, and hopefully we'll be able to just reveal a lot more of the universe out to very large distances that we can see today. And then that will help us understand a lot of different science questions, but a lot of things about galaxy evolution and these really, this big question mark that we have going, that we, between the first stars forming in the universe and then the galaxies we see around us today.
And so you were saying that the amount of stars that form changes over time in the universe, but also, does the type of stars that form seem to change over time as well? Because you were saying you were looking particularly at this infrared emission, which comes from these massive stars heating up their surroundings. And would you expect that you would still get the same types of stars forming over time, or different ones? Because then I guess that would change that infrared emission.
I'm not really an expert on that particular field, but I think the answer is we don't know. And I think part of the problem at the moment is that we really have to just assume that they stay the same because we don't have any better information. So for the large part, we have to assume that they stay the same and then make our measurements based on that. But, of course, that may not be correct at all. So with the telescopes of the future, hopefully we'll understand, what we call the initial mass function, which is the amount of the amount of stars at each mass, how many of those are formed in a certain period of star formation in a galaxy. And as we were talking about before, I need to know that because I need to know how many massive stars were formed in order to figure out the star formation rate of the galaxy from the radio light and from the infrared light that I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, it's like a ladder of calibration. And if the first rung of the ladder is broken, then the whole ladder doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's an excellent question, and we don't really know the answer yet.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking forward to next? You said you've just had a paper out. What are you planning to work on over the next year or so?
So what we have an idea to work towards in the future is to do a similar radio surveys, but at slightly different frequencies. Because we don't really understand the spectral landscape in the radio of galaxies. We always assume that it is a very boring shape. So you can model what you think the output of light at each frequency of radio light looks like, and we think it's really boring.
So it would look the same at different frequencies in the radio?
Not the same, but has a very simple shape. Okay. So increases steadily as your frequency is changing. But part of what we're doing here at the conference this week is discussing the fact that it's a lot more complicated than we thought it was. Basically, it's complicated. We've changed our status from in a relationship to it's complicated. And so in order to see whether that's true or not, we need a lot more data. So I think that's what we will work towards in the future, is to try and pin down the shape of this spectrum and whether or not that changes the rest of our results.
Well, great. Thank you for joining us on the Jodcast.
Thank you so much for having me.